Busted Like a Mule, Chapter 1. He was an ornery mean cuss that was oxbow strong and mule kick tough, and he didn't care if he won or lost as long as he was fighting. No one could say Cotton Kingfisher didn't live life like he meant it, though one couldn't say exactly what he meant when he was living it, just that he sure as hell meant it. He had a fire in his belly like a pot-bellied stove glowing, and that fire licked out at times and consumed those around him, I guess you could say. He'd break a fist and keep right on fighting. He'd love a woman, keep right on leaving. He'd fall over dead and keep right on drinking. He lost his driving license but kept right on driving. He was a man's man that none of the men liked. That's how goddamn rough and tumble he was, and may God strike me dead if I tell a lie. Being that Cotton was such a cuss, no one would think that a woman would cotton to him, no pun intended. But he got all the ladies he liked and more. Not the kind you'd take home to mama, of course, but barflies and floozies and burlesquies are women too, and some of them are damn beautiful enough to break a man's heart. But Cotton's heart had never been broke, because he wasn't jackass enough to hand it over to any one woman, or all of the above, for that matter. So he kept wham-bammin' and thank-you-mammin' from the south clean up into the west. When he first started to wander like Cain roaming over the face of the earth, he figured he had but a few choices as to which way to go. In the 30s, he was still in Oklahoma, the place of his birth, and things was dead and dying there at the time, like a horse taken out to pasture, so he knew he was already as far south as he wanted to go this side of hell. He could go north or east, but those places were filled with damn Yankees that thought they were something on a stick, and by God, they weren't nothing on a stick but sh**. Then there was the west, with all its wide open country. And cowboys and Indians. Real Indians like the kind you see in the movies. Not some drunk-ass old chief wearing white man's clothes begging for pennies outside in the street until the cops came and busted him and it busted your heart to see. No, real Indians, by God. When he left home, he was just a kid, so his Okie accent had kind of faded to a lazy blur by now, but it came roaring back when he was angry, and somehow he was always angry, so it was always roaring back, and people knew he was a Johnny Reb straight off, and he caught shit for it out west. Whether they liked to say that or not, he just did. And I don't know what this says about the states, but Cotton was mean enough to take on the whole west, by God, and he did. From the Dakotas to California and Oregon and Washington and Wyoming and Montana and even New Mexico and Arizona, raising Cain and hell all the while. So Cotton headed out west, just like all young men do at some point, or wish they did, or hell, they should, because the west is best. The place where the Johnny Reb and damn Yank meet together in a lawless frontier of pioneering spirit and manifest destiny, nestled between the bouncing breasts of Lady Liberty's national parks. Leastways, this is what Cotton thought, and he aimed to prove it, or at least to find out. He rode the rails a hell ton, as well as he went by way of his thumb, a big thumb, by God, hitching it on the American highway that was cutting concrete stretch marks across the belly of the states. Cotton had a big by God thumb, for when he was younger, he was working on a farm in Nevada, of all places, and they were laying down a cattle guard that was so goddamn heavy, they had to carry it with hay hooks, and lift and walk a pace, and then set it down, and lift and walk a pace, and set it down, and lift and walk a pace, and set it down, over and over until they got to where it was supposed to go, and they were laying it in place, and Cotton told them to hold it steady while he set it in place, and they didn't hold it steady, they dropped it, and a good goddamn 300 pounds or more squished his thumb flat. All Cotton could do was nothing, for it hurt so bad, until he finally hollered for him to get the goddamn monkey sucker thing off, with a bunch of other words those men had never even heard, and I bet those curse words are still smudging up the Nevada sky. They did lift the thing off finally, and I don't know if they did it on purpose for Cotton being a cuss and all, or if it was an accident, but Cotton thought they did it on purpose. And a lot more than them men's thumbs was flat when he got done with them and he had to leave Nevada straight away. I don't exactly know all where Cotton went in those years, sometimes staying in one place longer than others and maybe shacking up with a pretty girl or two, but he had spent more years wandering than not by the time this story takes place, and he wasn't young anymore like he used to be. His once easy rolling ways had turned to more like a creaking iron switch track lever being thrown every time he moved on. Maybe not in his soul, but in his bones, because his bones had been wandering like a skeleton out of the closet for quite a piece now, and them bones I'd wager was tired. But I guess that's bound to happen when you get a start like Cotton and keep on going, and this is how Cotton got started and kept on going. He got the stuffing kicked out of him, no pun intended, by his daddy when he was a boy, and he got sick of it, so he lit out when he was just a kid, though he had nowhere to go. He got robbed by a bunch of hobos on his first ride west, and they would have sodomized him. He heard them telling each other over the fire aside the railroad tracks, but Cotton wouldn't have none of that. And when they came at him thinking he was sleeping, he rolled over and slashed open one of them's faces with a broken piece of glass, and he kept right on slashing, and he killed one of them, by God. He was just 13 at the time, and he was never sodomized nor none tried thereafter, by God. He stoked up the hobo fire aside the tracks and threw the dead body he killed in it, and some of the others watched him do this as they moaned over their glass-slashed gashes, and Cotton said to them, "I could kill y'all right now, but I'll spare y'all, 'cause I'm just a boy yet." And he meant it. And those men had never heard such talk nor seen such things from but a boy. Cotton missed his family, but he never saw them again once he left, and maybe it was just as well, for he couldn't take his mama's dog sad eyes with a baby suckling at her bosom no more, though those eyes came back to haunt him as a grown man, especially after he heard many years ago she succumbed to hardship and was buried somewhere in the old hills of Oklahoma, wherein he used to roam, hiding out from his daddy. He guessed he missed his mama, he didn't rightly know, but it's hard to miss something when you don't know what it is, and you and I both know it, by God. So here he was now, the toughest rail rider to ever grace the Iron Python, and all the men respected and feared him, clean from his days as but a boy yet, when he killed that damn hobo who had tried to take advantage of him, furthered by his reputation as a fierce-ass brawler and mean old mule-strong cuss who was rougher than a cob. Tales live long on the rails like whispered mythologies over late-night star fires and in musty hay coal box cars sheltered from the rain, and the mythologies of Cotton was long and far and many. He had some men that tried to follow him like the apostles followed Jesus, but Cotton was no fisher of by God men, so he eventually managed to shake them so he could drink in solitude and listen to the whistle by the tracks and wander over open fields and look for Indians like he had since he was a boy. It always bothered him how he never saw many Indians out west, not like he thought he would as a boy. He guessed it was the same as Oklahoma, but he thought to see them with their feathers and robes and such when he had first come out west as a boy. Once in Seattle, he had seen some Injuns off their land the government had given them, or held them to, and they had their hair cut like white men, but Cotton could tell by their wild eyes that they hadn't been tamed, and he went up to them and said, "You lost your land and your homes and now your hair." And one of them Indians says, "We lost our path." And this made Cotton heart sick, though he told himself it was just the gut burn from the rot gut wine he was drinking. But you and I both know what that burn came from was a sick heart by what the Indian had said about losing their path. Cotton left Seattle by the sea after that and never returned, though he had to agree it was one of the most beautiful cities he'd ever seen by the inlet of the ocean ringed with great God mountains and pines. He didn't care much for the rain, though, always constantly misting down on you like God was crying because it rained so much even he got the blues. On the sunny days in Seattle, Cotton figured that this must be what Michael rowed his boat ashore for. But that was just on sunny days, and he was glad to leave the rain and his short-order cook job that he was about to lose because he had thrown a plate at an ornery cuss customer who said his steak was too well done and broke the poor bastard's nose, who was a banker and was likely to sue Cotton for all he had, which he didn't know was nothing, and bring the police down on him, so he left. He rode the shaken, sooty beast out of Washington and into Idaho, where he got into a ruckus with some foreign fruit pickers who, to his reputation, did not proceed, and they quarreled. Cotton couldn't understand a cotton-picking word that came out of their goddamn mouths. Even though he had worked with many foreign migrant workers, he took pride in not understanding them. But he didn't like the looks of them just the same, and there were 15 or 20 of them to his one. And they wanted his rucksack on his back over some misunderstanding, for he was being a surly cuss. And he said to them, "Go get in bed with your mama." And though none of them understood exactly what he said, they understood the gesture that preceded it from him. And they came at him all at once, and Cotton stood like a tree in a storm, like Samson amongst the Philistines as they rushed around him. And he brought his knotty pine ox-strong limbs down upon them and broke a few skulls and busted some arms and legs and noses. And his own nose got broke by God and his brow bled like hell. But he beat them lean, mean pickers down by sheer by God determination and righteous rage. And eventually the ones that were still standing fled like the Egyptians fled when the Red Sea came crashing in on them. But in that Bible story, the Red Sea wave swallowed all the Egyptians, whether they ran or not. And it was the same with those fleeing fruit pickers and the Red Sea crashing wave that was Cotton King Fisher. Cotton was left alone with a bunch of bodies around him like he was old Prophet What's-His-Name standing in the Valley of Dry Bones. For the first time in his life, he felt tore up and broke up and tired. The train rattled his bones hard, and the soot settled in his lungs heavy, and the blood coagulated on his face, and he felt all shook up and like the earth was trying to kill him, and he don't know how to make the earth happy. For the first time in his life, Cotton felt lost, real lost, truly lost, like he suddenly missed home, when he'd never had one in the first place, and he wasn't sure why, and even if he was sure why, it wouldn't do him no damn good, because he had no home to go back to. So after Idaho, Cotton hopped off the rails in Montana, looking for something that he wasn't sure existed, but he, by God, was going to look for it, and that thing he was looking for was home, or a rough approximation thereof, I suppose. Chapter 2. "Where the hell am I going?" Cotton asked the attendant at the filling station where he wandered to off the rails of Montana, and the boy just stared back at his blood-crusted mug and says, "Mister, are you okay?" "Hell yeah, son, where am I going?" Cotton goes on, lighting a smoke, and the kid says, "Well, that depends on where you're headed. I want to see some cotton-picking Indians, not the broke-ass kind that wear white man's clothes, but the kind that have feathers in their hair and robes and such." The boy attendant pushed his cap back on his head and scratched a bit and thought, and finally he says, "Well, you can always go up to Glacier National Park, and I think they have some Indians come down all in get-up." "Is it a smoke and mirrors get-up or a real get-up?" "Well, I guess I don't know, mister, just that they wear feathers and colorful blankets and such. The Blackfeet is up that-a-way." Cotton had heard of the Blackfeet and liked the sound of them, though he wasn't sure what being of Blackfeet meant, so he decided to follow that kid's finger pointing up north past some mountains. He washed himself up right in the filling station washing room with the travelers giving him dirty stares on account of he looked like he had been drugged through a knothole backwards. And him not giving a damn, well, maybe just a little, but only on account of his new feeling of sensitiveness in regards to the earth having it out for him. Then he hefted his Army-Navy rucksack and headed up into the meaty part of the Big Sky country, just west of where the Rocky Mountains jut up like a prehistoric crusty old spine and cut off the plains from the rest of the west. It was slow going up the road because no one was stopping for a stiff, walking, scarred-up, rucksack-wearing stranger, even though it was summer, and summer is the time when the place was alive with tourists come down to see Glacier Park up north where Cotton was headed. He gave up even having his thumb hung out like a tired old dog's tongue and went off the road a piece and built a fire and cooked himself a can of beans and drank from an old army canteen. Now, the thing about Cotton is he is a wanderer, but he wasn't no dad-blamed bum or beggar. He took care of himself, by God, and can't no man say different because he did, and that's the gospel truth. He worked for what he bought, when he worked, and when he bought, and he was proud of this, being he wasn't a bindle stiff, not into piddling. Once a man in a fancy hat gave Cotton some change on account of Cotton looked like a bum in his knapsack and all. And Cotton threw that change back in Fancy Hat's face, by God, being that he was not a bum, he was a hobo. You see, there is a difference from a hobo and a bum, and the difference is that a hobo chooses the life of the gypsy and he earns his way in it, while the bum just finds the wandering life like a leaf blown in the wind without purpose, and he's got no shame in begging. Not Cotton Kingfisher, by God, you'd never met a prouder man than he. And if you caught him begging, you'd have caught him dead, because I ain't never seen it, and ain't no one ever else, and if they tell you different, they are liars. But no one would tell you different, because the tales of Cotton still run strong and long along the rails like the whistle in the wind. Another thing about Cotton, as we see him setting there off in the pines, cooking his can of beans out of the big sky, big sun, is that he was mighty generous, even if he didn't want people to know that he was. He'd give you the shirt off his back if you were cold, and don't let any man tell you different, not even Cotton. He gave away cans of beans and ears of corn and field rabbits and scrounged grouse and even the leftovers of a venison he said he caught with his bare hands, though no one believed him but was too scared to tell him that no, he did not. He gave a black man all his cash once, and he gave an Indian back his blanket when the Indian lost it to Cotton in a drunken bet. And he said to this Indian, "Now who's the Indian giver?" And they got along fine after that. But he earned what he owned is what I'm trying to say to you, though little it was, like that Army-Navy rucksack, and that can of beans he is eating right there in the Montana sun, and those railroad worker pants, and those red-winged boots, and those T-shirts, and those denim jackets, and flannel shirts, and the wool bedroll that the Indian gave him back after Cotton had given it back to him after he lost it fair and square to Cotton in a drunken bet. Even the railroad engineer cap he wears when it gets hotter than old Blicky's, he got fair and square-jawed. He got that there hat, one of his most prized possessions, from a hoghead, which is what the hobos call a rail engineer, who had grown real fond of Cotton through all his rail-riding years and refused to let anyone throw Cotton off the train, and that agreement still goes on as long as the length of the track from Seattle down to New Mexico, though the last I heard, that hoghead is dead and gone, God rest his soul. Cotton took his time eating his beans right out of the can, heated in the coals, and he listened to a murder of crows and a gaggle of trees calling him bad names, even though he was awful fond of the black-burned birds himself, as he sees them as his angels that follow him wherever he goes, no matter what they caw otherwise. Then he rolled out his wool blanket and fell asleep beside the fire every now and again, hearing a car rush past, but not caring because he was too wore out to go and catch it with his thumb like a dog running down a meal cart. He slept in peace without all the aches left over from his heartbreaking fight, and he dreamt, but he wished he wouldn't, because he had the dream he always had of his daddy, and the dream goes like this, but it ain't really a dream, just a retelling of the tale from Cotton's past played on the back of his eyelids. Cotton's daddy wasn't a nice man and a lousy cuss drunk to boot, but he liked to play music on the guitar and sing, and Cotton had never heard anything so beautiful as when his daddy would play and sing, even if he had to listen outside the shack because he didn't want to stir up his daddy's violent tendencies towards the boy being himself. Cotton's heart would be filled up with strange stirrings, as if angels themselves were singing those country and western songs his daddy was singing in that high, oaky voice of his, and he would just sit and listen outside the shack. One time, right before Cotton fled from the Oklahoma hills forever, his daddy laid into him good and liked to break his nose, hadn't his mama pulled his old man off of him, and then his daddy lit into her until Cotton grabbed a piece of firewood and hit his daddy's skull so hard he cold-cocked the mean old son of a bitch. Now Cotton's mama stood up, smoothing out her threadbare dress, like nothing had just occurred, though Cotton had seen it occur with his own two eyes, and he could see her bleeding from the mouth and nose with his own two eyes. They say this is where Cotton's legendary rage comes in when he sees his mama standing there bleeding and smiling, eyes darting like a scared rabbit and a bleeding trickle from the lip and nose. I can't say for sure because I think Cotton had the rage before that, and I wager one has to have the rage to survive a daddy like that. But whatever the case may be, he went and he got his daddy's guitar, and he went and he busted it right over his daddy's passed out noggin, and he kept beating and beating until his mama pulled him off, and his daddy's head was flowing blood and that guitar was a splintered mess of a wreck. Then he went and hid up in a tree. He expected his daddy to come out roaring after him into the cicada humid night. But night fell, and all he heard from the house was his daddy weeping when his daddy saw that his guitar was all busted up, because they were dirt broke poor and guitars were like gold. Cotton sat up in that tree hiding out from his daddy, hearing him in the house crying, and he felt so sad all over because his daddy was sad, even though his daddy was the devil. This is when Cotton knew he would never hear his daddy sing nor play ever again. And this is when he lit out for the West and never looked back. But all that to say that Cotton would dream about this incident from time to time, and he dreamt it now as he slept there in the pines under the big sky beside the road to Glacier Park on his bedroll that the Indian had give back to him, that blanket being one of his most favorite things. You've been listening to Busted Like a Mule, written and read by me, Caleb Bannon. It was recorded and edited by Mike Ailman as well as Vern Windham, who produced it for Spokane Public Radio. Busted Like a Mule is available on Amazon and Kindle. It is also at some libraries as well as major booksellers, including Auntie's, of course. For more information, you can visit my website, CalebBannon.com.